Welcome to episode 68 of the Introvert Entrepreneur Podcast. I'm Beth Below. When I started down the entrepreneurial path, one of the first books I turned to was Pamela Slim's Escape from Cubicle Nation. It wasn't because I was necessarily escaping from a cubicle. I actually loved the job I had previously and only gave it up because my husband and I chose to make a cross-country move. But the book captured the spirit of adventure that I was feeling, and it provided a sensible roadmap for action in those early days. I also appreciated that someone was willing to share an unflinching look at the realities of entrepreneurship. While Pamela is a self-proclaimed extrovert, she has insights and wisdom that will give even the most introverted among us food for thought. Pamela is an award-winning author, business coach, and speaker. She spent the first 10 years of her business as a consultant to large companies such as Hewlett-Packard, Charles Schwab, and Cisco Systems, where she worked with thousands of executives, managers, and employees. In 2005, she started the Escape from Cubicle Nation blog, which is now one of the top career and business blogs on the web. Pamela's first book, Escape from Cubicle Nation, From Corporate Prisoner to Thriving Entrepreneur, was released in the spring of 2009 and won Best Small Business Entrepreneur Book of 2009 by 800 CEO Read. Her new book, Body of Work, gives a fresh perspective on the skills required in the new world of work for people in all work modes, from corporate to nonprofit to small business. Hi, Pam. Welcome to the Introvert Entrepreneur Podcast. I'm super excited to be talking with you today.
And likewise, I am super excited to be here.
Well, what is making you smile today?
I will admit that I'm a bit of a fan of sappy YouTube videos. And the latest one that I saw yesterday was there were these sweet two boys that were on Britain's Got Talent who wrote a song together about bullying, and one of them had really been bullied, and he loved to rap, and then his other friend had kind of this sweet, you know, Justin Timberlake-like voice. So they did a song together about bullying, and it was just so sweet. I mean, the music was really wonderful, and the message was great, and their story was great, and the audience really got into it, and I just love that kind of stuff. It really makes me happy and excited about the next generation when I see stories like that.
I feel like I need to take an entire week off and catch up on all of those kinds of videos and be inspired and learn what's going on in the world, because there's so much. What I love about the internet is it's bringing out so much of that kind of goodness.
Exactly. And that's a matter of selectively choosing what you see. I was at a pool party in my neighborhood with somebody who's in Cub Scouts, who we often just see each other over Facebook. And she was saying, "Oh man, I think I want to quit because, you know, there's just so much negativity." And I said, "No, don't quit Facebook. Just change the friends you have on Facebook."
Exactly. You're hanging out with the wrong people.
That's right. There's tons of uplifting information. Just filter your messages.
Exactly. Well, before we jump into talking about your work, because I want to talk about Escape from Cubicle Nation a little bit and then your latest book, Body of Work, I'd love to know a little bit about your own introvert-extrovert story. What do you consider yourself on the spectrum, and how did you come to know where you fell?
I consider myself pretty much a raging extrovert on the spectrum, which is not a scientific number. My Myers-Briggs was probably the first time that I really dug into introversion and extroversion in my consulting days, because I was a training and development management consultant for about 10 years before I started to work with entrepreneurs. And so I did a lot of work inside companies, and I got certified in Myers-Briggs. And I think that's when I first took the test, which folks who have taken that may know introversion or extroversion is one component of the four parts that you test for. And so the definition that I had always understood was that it was about how you got energized, which always made sense with the metaphor of thinking about how it is that you recharged your battery. You know, extroverts, we charge up with people, and introverts alone and having quiet reflective time. So that was really the first part where I began to understand, you know, my extroversion. But one of the things that I've learned, and I've been doing a lot of work with Susan Cain, who's the author of Quiet, who folks may be familiar with, and really getting a nuanced view about it. I actually didn't know until I think it hit me about December of last year. I've been working with Susan since last July. And I just quickly touched off an email and said, "Oh my God, my entire family are introverts. And my husband, like my mom, dad, sister, and brother are all introverts. And like, I always knew my brother was because he is probably as much on the introvert scale as mm-hmm. I'm on the extrovert scale. Mm-hmm. But I suddenly realized my entire family was. And that was a really deep realization. I think that's where my love and my passion for being a quiet introvert revolutionary comes from, is that I actually take great comfort in quiet moments because that's what I know to be the norm in my family environment.
And that awareness has probably led to, much richer relationships, deeper relationships and understanding with your family members.
It really has. We've talked about it through the work that we've done. And, you know, we like to talk about, work things and get insight into each other. I mean, one thing I realize is just what kind of patience they have, because I've heard a lot of stories from folks who are in a similar situation where they were just told to shush, mm-hmm. Same thing as introverts who were told to be more like your sister, like get out there, talk, why don't you, participate more. The same thing is often true for folks who are extroverts in an introverted family, is we're told to really pull back. Whereas my family was just really patient and just listened to me talk a lot and be the first on the dance floor, as a kid and all those kind of things. But it gave me an appreciation for the nature of communication. And it also gave me insight sometimes to where I would have that feeling after being with my family for a long time of kind of needing to be around a little bit more of an extroverted environment, because I could just feel how my energy was a little overwhelming when given in large doses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
To my patient family.
Yes, they OD'd a little bit. And then you were under, you were probably needed more. And that's why you were seeking out some fellow extroverts. Even though you're around people, they weren't necessarily the people that were going to, even though you love them, yeah. They're not going to feed your extrovert energy as much as some other folks might. Well, what a gift that you've given them and that they gave you with that patience.
It's amazing. I am so appreciative of it. I really am. And I think all of us extroverts can really benefit from the natural strengths of introverts, from, building in more quiet, reflective time and solitude. And there's so many good things I think we can learn from each other.
Well, a lot of your work has resonated with me, and I think part of it is because you seem to have a sensitivity to that introvert-extrovert. Even if you don't use those words, there are certain things you say that just resonate with me. One of those was in Escape from Cubicle Nation, when you write about the essential self and the social self. First, maybe tell us what the difference between each of these selves is, and what's most important to understand in life first, before we talk about, how it applies to professional environments.
The essential and social selves is a concept from Martha Beck, who I train with as a life coach, and she wrote a great book called Finding Your Own North Star, mm-hmm. which is where that concept comes from. And it is really looking at, when we're born, we have our essential self. A good way to think about it is just your two-year-old self. For those of you who have kids or are around kids, you know what I mean. There's not a lot of editing.
No filter.
Your emotions, right? Like whatever you feel is exactly what you describe. So the essential self is really just your raw emotional self, where you're not filtering anything that you're saying. So we all come into the world with our essential selves, but then we're shaped by all kinds of different factors. We're shaped by our families. We're shaped by, religious institutions, by educational institutions, the media. And this is where you can begin to see different kind of biases that come through. In quiet, we talk a lot about the extrovert bias, mm-hmm. where a lot of what society in general says through our educational institutions and through the media and through professional environments, we say, if you are a leader, you need to speak up more. You need to participate in meetings. You need to always be working in groups. You don't want to be shy in a wallflower. And obviously this is not true. It's mm-hmm. it's not really looking, I don't think, accurately at how introverts are wired. But imagine that you have this social self vision where you have your feeling of, that you are a strong, powerful being who has a great way of interacting with the world. But then the messages that you often get from your social environment say, this is the way that you need to behave in order to be accepted. Martha often says, it's not that the social self is bad and the essential self is good. It's as if your essential self decides that you want to be a doctor and your social self is going to take the MCAT and go to medical school, right? Sometimes there are things you need to be, ways you can interface with society to help your essential self get to where it wants to go, where you start to have problems, as you said, not just in your work life, but all over, is where you don't know the difference between your essential and your social self, and where your social self is pushing you in a different direction than where your essential self naturally wants to go.
And therein the trouble lies.
Yes.
Yeah, I often talk about these as core and cultivated. So the core being the essential and like who you are at your core, and then what you have cultivated over the years based on feedback from society, based on what you were told was okay. And sometimes, like you said, you know, there needs to be an alignment between those two things. And so I think that cultivated or that social self needs to come out of the essential self, as opposed to being seen as something that's totally separate from and not related.
So true. It just, that's the root of everything about how it is that you walk through the world in, I think, a powerful way, a powerful, grounded way, is where it is reflected that your social self, you know, how you appear is really actually how you are. One of my favorite questions I got once from somebody in a Q&A I was doing was, how do I appear more authentic online? Which I thought was a hysterical question, because it's about appearing authentic, you be authentic.
Yes. Yeah. Great point. Well, what's important to understand about this, you know, some of my listeners are in traditional work environments and hoping someday to make that leap to entrepreneurship. Where does the understanding of the essential and social self come into play when it comes to that?
It does, first of all, in deciding what exactly that you want to do and why you want to do it. In the 8 years that I focused on Escape from Cubicle Nation and working with folks, one of the things that I would do before we got into any kind of business planning was really to look at the motivations as to why does somebody actually want to go out and work for themselves. And hating your job intensely is not a business plan. And a lot of people, I think, can be in a bad work situation and feel like entrepreneurship is the answer to everything. And sometimes that's fueled by the internet and great stories of people who travel the world and appear to have this glamorous life. And, you know, sometimes that's true. There's cool things that can happen when you work for yourself. However, really what you want to do is figure out what are the unique skills and strengths you have, what are your areas of true passion and interest, and then how do those actually meet the needs of the market? They have to meet the need of the market, and they have to meet your own skills and capabilities for being able to create a viable business. Sometimes, very often, most times, we don't have all of the skills that we need in order to do every part of running a business. And so that's also what can help you identify who you need to have around you in terms of resources or business partners or things like that, you know, in order to get something done. But depending upon how frozen people's souls are when they're in a corporate life, and for some people that's the case, that they've not listened to their essential self for a really, really long time. When it came to choosing their major in college, when it came to choosing what company to work for and what career path to take, a lot of people just go on autopilot and don't make a conscious decision. I mean, to be fair, some people really do. And there are people who are super happy in corporate environments. And I think that's important to share, you know, but there's others who are extremely disconnected from their essential self. And so the first part of the process is really thawing out, you know, that voice, often doing things that have nothing to do with business at all. One assignment I gave to a coaching client a while back, she was just not sure what direction she wanted to go and was really kind of flailing around a little bit and was frustrated. And I said, well, what do you really love to do? What's something that just brings you inherent joy? And she said, musical theater. I said, all right, you know, take a sick day, go into the city and see a show. Mm-hmm. And she came back and she had such a different energy because she put herself in that zone of real connection with her essential self, being lit up by something that was highly enjoyable.
What if she said, I want to make a business out of being involved in musical theater? One thing that I have also experienced with colleagues is a little bit of a fear of taking that essential self and monetizing it. Any thoughts on what one should consider around that?
How long do you have?
Yeah, I know. That's a whole nother podcast, probably.
No, it's a great question. I actually have many thoughts about that. And that's what I mean. It's like where hating your job is not a business plan. Feeling a passion is not a business plan either. And it can be fantastic where your area of passion and interest is something that you can create a viable business, you know, out of and a business model from. But not every passion has the capability to be monetized. And I've seen a lot of people chase after that and really, you know, pour a lot of money and energy and heartache into trying to make something happen that maybe doesn't have a natural business in it. You know, there's not really viability. So what I love to be surrounded by all kinds of different people to get different perspectives. And sometimes you have to fortify yourself emotionally. You really want to be clear as to why and how you're getting feedback about different things at different stages of business. You know, a lot of people who are going to encourage you and, you know, keep pushing you forward. But then if you can have somebody who's a friend or family member or a colleague who will just really take the devil's advocate role and somebody who has experience with business viability, right? With like really understanding how business works, who has experience in the startup world, who can poke a whole bunch of holes at what your idea is. That is so useful because, and you know, if it really does have viability, then that's going to be a great discussion to help you just fortify your business model and move forward. But a lot of people, I think, get stuck just chasing the idea that whatever you find that you're passionate about is what you should start a business around. And my main argument is often that you want to be creating a body of work that's very significant to you, that's meaningful. And so you use your life to have impact in the world. And there are different chess pieces that you can use in order to do that, right? Some people choose to have a job that pays really well, that they enjoy, that, you know, they feel good about, but that actually allows them to have time and energy to be focused on volunteer projects or, you know, being a great parent or whatever it is. There are other people who really like to use work as a way that they're truly focusing on specifically channeling their passions and interests into concrete things that they create through their body of work. So there's like, there's no right answer. But all of us need to have that perspective of pursuing work that allows us to utilize our strengths and be creating things that we feel personally are adding value to the world and are meaningful and significant. But I think we worship work mode too much. We worship, you know, working for yourself versus working for somebody else. And that can get us in trouble.
And that's one thing that came up as I was thinking of our conversation is this idea that we talk about traditional works environments and entrepreneurship as being non-traditional, and therefore it sort of gets romanticized when we frame it that way. What have you noticed about the way people are looking at traditional versus non-traditional work? I mean, do you think that we romanticize entrepreneurship and that kind of gets us in a little bit of trouble?
I think we do. It's one of the reasons why I wrote Body of Work is because I saw it so much in the work I was doing in the entrepreneurial space, and it's very light and dark side of the force. Mm-hmm. The reality is there are many, many people who are doing amazing work in the context of organizations with, you know, small businesses, medium, large, academic institutions, nonprofits, that so much of our experience is driven by how we think about work and how we consciously choose the conditions around us that bring out our best work. So for example, there are some people who, as Dan Pink would say in his great book Drive, you know, they love autonomy. They want to feel like they have a say in what work they do and how it's done and when it's done, for example. But they're not necessarily like huge risk takers for wanting to constantly be in business development mode, you know, for drumming up business. So this could be a person that would look for the kind of work environment where the culture was such that you had great autonomy. You know, you were given a task and you had to figure out how to do it. And yet you get a paycheck every 2 weeks, you know, and that's great. That could feel like support to one person versus somebody else who may feel like autonomy actually means I get to absolutely control my destiny at every stage. You know, I would kind of put myself in that category where I work with all kinds of different people. I have different clients, but I love to have the feeling at the end of the day of knowing at any time I can say, you know what, I think I want to shift. I think I want to go a new direction. I want to focus on a new market. And I like to not have to worry about any kind of internal organizational negotiation.
I remember feeling this tremendous sense of freedom when I first started my business, when I realized that it was important for me to start my business. It was something I felt called to move forward. You know, I wasn't running away from something. I was moving towards something. And I knew that at some point, if I chose and I wanted to go back to a traditional work environment, in my case, it was nonprofits, that was okay. That was a choice I could make. And it would, again, be about moving towards something rather than away from it. And I think that for me, that has created, like I said, just a freedom in the way I'm approaching things and not seeing anything as good or bad. But like you said, saying, okay, I think I'm going to shift here and do something different.
That's awesome. And, you know, what is a traditional work environment today?
Right. Like, what is it?
Everything is in flux. Everything is changing. So I think even that idea is not accurate. Mm-hmm. There's not a type of role that you can take that just guarantees that you're going to be employed for the rest of your life, even if you wanted to do that.
Yes.
You need to be managing your career in a different way.
I remember about 10 years ago, maybe I was in nonprofit fundraising and I picked up a newsletter, you know, like a professional association newsletter. And they said, stop thinking of yourself as an employee and think of yourself as an independent contractor and that you happen to be working for this organization at this time. And it was that first introduction to that idea of seeing myself as that, you know, brand you sort of thing. And again, you know, something that was very liberating. And like you just said, it shows that any sense of security we might have is not necessarily true. And that's not to be, you know, pessimistic about anything, but just that, you know, all of us need to be entrepreneurial in spirit and to have that sense of fluidity with how we're looking at our work.
That's exactly it. And just the one thing I really want to encourage is to just to remove any shame about decisions that you make. And that can be something I've seen, you know, as a trend where some people might want to work for themselves and they, you know, sometimes they do it successfully for a while. And then for a variety of different reasons, they decide they want to go back. And for other people, they try it and it really is hard and it doesn't work and they want to go back, but they feel like somehow they failed, you know, and that's what I just really coach the heck out of people to just think about it in a very different way, that all that you're trying to do is to find the right kind of structure to support the work that you want to create and bring out in the world. And there is no work mode that is inherently better than another.
Well, as we've been chatting, a thread that's been through the conversation a little bit is about reaching out to other people and finding support. And one of the things you observe in body of work, that one of the sentences that jumped out at me that said, when you're in a stuck place and feel overwhelmed, the one thing that will not make you feel better is spending more time alone thinking. Well, you know, from now your awareness of how introverts work, we can actually spend quite a bit of time alone thinking. And often it's our default, you know, we say, I need to go away and think about this, but that might not always be in our best interests, you know, if we do it for too long. And it can be challenging to ask for help, because then that means we have to bring somebody else into our thought process. And we see it as a last resort, honestly. What advice would you have for someone, especially the introvert, who is averse to kind of opening themselves up and asking for help?
Yeah, I feel like in the next edition, I should you know, change that and put a caveat. the nuance to it is, yes, there are times, especially respecting the natural strengths of introverts, where a great way to synthesize ideas and figure out what you want to do is to spend time alone thinking about them, for sure. And that's something that extroverts could do, too. Mm-hmm. The pattern that I see often with many of my introverted clients is that, as you said, does become the default, and you can get lost and feel isolated in ideas. I think there's a way of connecting as an introvert that still respects how it is that you like to connect, where you don't have to be, you know, working the room in a huge room of 50 people. Often you can create a very intimate small group, for example, or have somebody else who is a mastermind partner, somebody who you could work with, but where you can share ideas and get some kind of feedback. And I think that's really the part that I see when you've had time to sit back and really think of what it is that you want to do, and then you want to begin to get it out and test it. The nature of being an entrepreneur, it has interaction involved in it. And that's where you can set the kind of parameters about what is the way that you want to be driving those interactions and how is it that you want to be reaching out, because it can be very isolating. It's like any strength, right? The extroverted work in the room at all times, flying around, you know, always seeing people, which sometimes I did. I just had, I don't know, a few weeks ago, like 7 days in a row where I was, you know, flying to a number of different destinations, big speaking events, you know, which I love, meeting a lot of people, shaking hands, signing books, you know, speaking. And at the end of it, I just felt like I was like coming down off a booze binge or something. I don't even drink, but like it just did not feel good. And the opposite thing can happen for somebody who's an introvert, where a naturally good environment of having quiet, reflective time ends up being isolating. So I think part of what you want to be looking at is, how are you going to begin to build those relationships? I've found a lot of success in online connections. The place where I've connected with a lot of my introverted clients has been in teaching classes online. You know, I did one with Chris Guillebeau, who is a big introvert, by the way.
Yes, I'm talking to him later this week.
Are you? That's awesome. Yes. Tell him I said hi.
We'll do.
See him in Berlin in a couple of weeks. But, you know, Chris is a big introvert. We did a class together called the $100 Business Startup. And that's where we ended up finding a number of people as students that were introverted, that enjoyed having an interaction, you know, emailing back and forth or sharing in forums, would find a connection with somebody that they resonated with, and then just begin to build smaller networks and groups of people.
So continuing to build it on that one-on-one as it fits with your preferences and your strengths.
Exactly. You know, I do think we all need each other, and we just need each other in different ways. Not everybody needs as many of each other as I do.
Right. Nicely put. Well, speaking of defining terms, the last question I wanted to ask you about was defining success. It's one of the ways I start out my coaching relationships with my clients, is talking about, what is your definition of success? And you used a phrase I love, which is success dysmorphia. I'd love for you to tell us what success dysmorphia is, and then maybe talk a little bit about how we can get to our own definition of success.
Success dysmorphia was something that I wrote a blog post about after having a conversation with a good friend of mine, Eric Prue, who, again, is an introverted filmmaker who made a great film called Lemonade. And he was working on a second project, Detroit Lemonade, about all the amazing ways that the people of Detroit, in an underground way, were really creating a renaissance of a city that's been so devastated, you know, in our national economy. So he was working on all these amazing things for, you know, raising money for his documentary. And I was doing my thing, raising kids and coaching clients and stuff. And we were talking about some of our mutual friends who appeared to just have it so much more together. And we're like, oh man, you know, Jonathan's doing this and so-and-so's doing that. And all of a sudden I was like, listen to us. Like, this is really ridiculous. We're kind of romanticizing somebody else's success. And what we're doing in a not so subtle way is totally discounting that success which we have. Mm-hmm. And let's just take a moment and make sure that we're measuring ourselves against that criteria, which is actually important to us. And I know for both Eric and I, you know, having a focus on our kids is really important, and having a focus on the right kind of creative projects, and not just pursuing money for money's sake, but really pursuing meaning, is something that's a value. So it just drove this whole interest. It was one of those threads that eventually turned into body of work and successes as a chapter about defining your own success. And I think that it's something that sometimes people know right away what it is. And other times, you probably find this also as a coach, it's something that you need to actually reflect on, and reflect on times when you really have been happy or when you truly felt successful. Sometimes it's because you have taken the time to actually allow yourself to feel that success and not deflected it and not said, oh, that's okay. Or, oh, but you know, Beth did it so much better, so I'm not really that great, you know, because look at what she did. Mm-hmm. But really, really taking the time to be owning your success. And this is where understanding your essential self becomes so important, because you realize, what are your true drivers? Usually it's your underlying values, your beliefs, the things that when you act upon them, they give you natural, inherent, physiological joy, as opposed to the social self things that we think we should do, or, you know, looking to models of success that we think we should have, even if they're not actually what makes us happy.
And yeah, it's the difference between the internal motivation and the external motivation, and really knowing, like you said, what drives you from the inside, from that essential self. So key to making good choices, I think.
Yeah. And the one thing I think it's important to distinguish is, it doesn't mean that your own definition of success doesn't include creating a $10 million business.
Exactly.
Or, you know, landing on the New York Times list. It's not what you put on the list, but it's why. Mm-hmm. And making sure that for some people, they don't need or want those huge external metrics. For other people, that's really motivating. That represents something more, right? That represents effort, that represents impact or excellence or mastery or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's really important just to define it for yourself, whatever that is, to own it.
Exactly. That's what I'm hearing from what you're saying. The bottom line is whatever it is, understand it and own it and live into it.
Yes.
Thank you. Well, a closing question that I ask all of my guests, and imagine you just finished that 7-day whirlwind, perhaps, and you're ready for a little bit of time on Introvert Island, and you've gotten a 3-week vacation, and you can only take 3 books with you. What would you take with you and why?
Let's see. I think it would assume that I can reread some dearly beloved books, probably because Gabriel Garcia Marquez just passed away. May he rest in peace. 100 Years of Solitude, which I think is probably my favorite book of all time, and I haven't read it in a long time. I just went on a total Isabel Allende binge when I was traveling. I love A House of the Spirits is another one. I love magical realism. Another one would be If You Want to Write by Brenda Uland, U-E-L-A-N-D, which is a beautiful book written by her. She's a writing teacher, and she wrote it in like 1936 or something. It's still a wonderful book. I don't know. I kind of have to think about like what a third would be. You know, probably it would be Resonate by my good buddy Nancy Duarte, who I worship.
Yes.
The ground she walks on, because I feel like Resonate, which is about the art of storytelling, is such a deep and rich book that even though I've read it a couple times, I feel like I could really read it again and get even more from it.
It was really wonderful. I think she was the very first speaker at last year's World Domination Summit, one of the first main stage speakers. And I think she just blew the room away. Yeah, highly recommend.
She did. I was very proud. I got to introduce her, which was fantastic because I love her so much. But I actually recommended her to WDS. So I was gloating. I was sitting on the side of the stage gloating. So I was like,
look what I brought you.
Why we wanted Nancy Duarte.
Awesome. Well, thank you for that then. We owe it all to you. So what's the best way for people to connect with you and keep up with you and what you're up to?
My main site is PamelaSlim.com. So that's where you can find me all the, you know, social ways that we can connect on Twitter or Facebook, whatever. And I'm also really excited about the work that I'm doing with Susan Cain and Mike Irwin. Mike is an amazing guy who teaches leadership at West Point, and he is heading up, along with our colleague Jeff Bryan, the Quiet Leadership Institute, and we're developing all kinds of really amazing, cool tools to help people really understand and harness the natural power of introverts in the workplace. And this is like taking my longtime interest in diversity and respecting others and kind of bringing it to a different level. So we're going to be right now, I'm thinking of the time that you publish this podcast, and those folks who are familiar with Susan Cain, you can just go ahead and jump on her newsletter list. But very, very soon, just stay tuned with social channels, because Quiet Revolution is a bigger project that Susan's working on, the Quiet Leadership Institute being just a portion of that. And I'm just really proud of all the work that's happening and the kind of people who are involved. So that, I'm thinking, for your audience would be something that would be super interesting. And just stay tuned. Maybe you can post as well. Like once, I'm not sure exactly when the site is going to be going live. But Susan recently spoke at TED 2014 and outlined a little bit of her vision about what's next. So you can just Google Susan Cain TED and get a little bit more information there.
Fabulous. Thank you. Thank you so much for being part of the Quiet Revolution. You're a great partner for all of us. So thank you.
I appreciate it. You know, again, we all need each other, right? We all need to be harnessing each other's strengths. And I've always been a huge proponent and had an interest in diversity in general. Mm-hmm. And this is just neat to be also seeing of how it takes place in terms of what our different communication styles are.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Pam. It has been a great pleasure chatting with you. I really appreciate it.
Likewise.
This conversation brought forward a lot of points for reflection, starting with Pam's description of her family life and awareness of her personal energy. For instance, what kind of environment did you grow up in? How did you navigate energetic differences with the people around you? How does knowing about your social self help you to live in alignment with your essential self? Who in your life gives you honest feedback about your ideas or is willing to play the devil's advocate? Who supports you when you need it the most? And where might you be experiencing success dysmorphia? How do you define success for yourself? I invite you to take some time to think about these questions and see where your answers take you. And in closing, I want to share how much I love this particular takeaway from the conversation. How do you appear authentic? You be authentic. Thank you so much for listening today. If you want to learn more about me and The Introvert Entrepreneur, I invite you to visit my website at www.theintrovertentrepreneur.com. The site includes links to my blog, social media communities, book, and coaching services. I'd love to hear from you. This is Beth Below, and until we meet again, remember that success is an inside job.